on the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Dan Friedel has an update on the record-setting potato found in New Zealand. John Russell presents this week's Everyday Grammar Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, two property developers in California are turning huge industrial spaces into shelters for homeless people. The developers, brothers Ryan and Jeremy Ogolnik, created their first shelter in just under a month in the Orange County city of Santa Ana. The effort helped the city deal with its homeless crisis. The brothers then repeated the process in the nearby cities of Anaheim and Fullerton. They were able to convert properties into shelters in a matter of months. In each case, the Ogolniks also made a profit for themselves. Such shelters have given a second chance to people like Roland Flores. The 48-year-old was living with his grandmother as her caretaker and lost the home when she died. Today, he lives at the Fullerton shelter. During his 9-month stay at the shelter, he has been able to seek medical treatment and get his birth certificate and social security card. "They're giving me the tools that I need," Flores said of the workers at the shelter. The nonprofit group Illumination Foundation operates the Fullerton shelter. Ryan Ogolnik said he could buy 50 such shelters across Southern California if the money was available. Instead of leasing the spaces to private companies, they are rented to a city or to homeless services providers. "It's such a simple solution," Ogolnik said. His company, Vineyards Development, invested $9.2 million to rebuild the new Santa Ana Carnegie shelter over a period of 9 months. The company will rent it to the Illumination Foundation and the city for $44,000 a month when it opens next week. As quick and simple as they are, these emergency shelters are only a short-term solution. Affordable housing is limited, and housing costs continue to rise. Some critics are worried that Orange County officials are content with a solution that does not lead to permanent housing for the homeless. It's very clear that the strategy being used right now in Orange County is more about appearances than solutions, said lawyer Brooke Weitzman. She is co-founder of Elder Center, a law office representing people who are homeless, older, or disabled. Last year, the United States was about 7 million units short of enough affordable housing, said a study by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. In Los Angeles County, the homeless population is estimated at 66,000. Orange County, just south of LA County, has a homeless population of about 7,000. Nearly 60% of the homeless population is unsheltered, the latest complete count in 2019 found. Shelters increased in numbers after a 2018 federal appeals court ruling banned police from arresting people on the streets if a community lacks enough shelter beds. Emergency shelter beds in Orange County increased 159% from 2015 to 2021, according to Orange County Homeless Management Information System data. However, permanent supportive housing, which provides housing as well as social services, grew by just 13% over that same period. Instead of building actual affordable housing, what they've done is throw up mass shelters, said Eve Garrow. She is a homelessness policy expert and activist at the ACLU of Southern California. Paul Leon is president and CEO of the Illumination Foundation. He agrees that more housing is needed, but he said many people are unprepared to go immediately from the street to being responsible for a home. His foundation has operated all of the shelters built by the Ogulniks. The foundation offers support services, including health care and mental health and drug abuse counseling. The Ogulniks turned a former engineering company in an industrial area into the 150-bed Fullerton Navigation Center. In an effort to reduce complaints from neighbors, the shelter bans residents from walking in and out. This keeps them out of public view. Shelter vehicle drivers take residents in and out through a side gate. Leon said most people with support move from the streets to homes of their own. Some of those who do not may go to jail or return to the streets. That tells us we need more housing, Leon said. Weitzman has concerns about Ogulnik's claims about the speed and cost-effectiveness of mass shelters. She said the best solution to homelessness has always been housing. When people are homeless, they're those homeless folks, Weitzman said. And when people are housed, they're your neighbors.
Last year, a husband and wife in New Zealand thought they had found a record-breaking potato in their garden. A potato is a round, root-like food that is eaten as a vegetable and is popular around the world. Colin Craig Brown found the potato with his wife, Donna. They dug it up and put it on a scale. It weighed nearly 8 kilograms. They even named the potato Doug, D-O-U-G, or Doug, D-U-G, because they dug it up from their garden. Doug the potato became famous. But then the two sent some of the potato to the Guinness Book of World Records, based in Britain, to confirm their record. After months of submitting photos and papers, Colin and Donna recently got some bad news. It turns out what they found in their garden was not a potato after all. It was a different kind of plant. Guinness said they had found the tuber of a gourd. For this reason, we do unfortunately have to disqualify the application, the email from Guinness read. So the existing record still stands. That potato weighed about 5 kilograms when it was found in Britain in 2011. Colin said what he found tasted and looked like a potato, but he was not objecting to Guinness's decision. After all, he sent them a sample and the organization tested its DNA. What can you say? Colin asked. A gourd, however, is a kind of decorative fruit with a hard shell. the tuber is a stem that grows out of the gourd. Even though Doug is no longer the world's largest potato, Colin is still happy to have found such an interesting thing in his garden. Doug is in his freezer. He said he still says good day to Doug each morning when he takes food from the freezer. While he was disappointed with the Guinness decision, Colin said he is ready to give it another try during the next growing season, and this time it will definitely be a potato. I'm Dan Friedel.
Imagine you want to describe why you did something, or why something happened. In other words, you want to talk about a reason. In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore a few common structures that English speakers use to talk about reasons. You will learn about conjunctions and expressions with the word reason in them. Let's start with the importance of conjunctions. Conjunctions join together sentences, clauses, phrases, or words. Common conjunctions include words such as and, but, because. Because is of special importance for today's report. It is commonly used to explain why something is. Its exact meaning is for the reason that. Consider the following statement. I listen to Everyday Grammar because I want to improve my understanding of English grammar. In our example, because joins different clauses. The first clause is, I listen to Everyday Grammar. The second clause is, I want to improve my understanding of English grammar. Please note that because can be used in different places in a sentence, the beginning or the middle. How might one change our previous example to have because at the beginning of the sentence? You might say something like this. Because I want to improve my understanding of English grammar, I listen to Everyday Grammar. English speakers sometimes use expressions with the noun reason to explain why something should be. One of these often appears in its negative form. It is, there is no reason why. Let's listen to Carol Fishman Cohen use this structure in a TED Talk.
In fact, an employer just told me that their veterans return to work program is based on their reentry internship program. And there's no reason why there can't be a retiree internship program.
But English speakers do not only use the noun reason in negative statements. English speakers often use structures such as the reason or the only reason. For example, when making a phone call, a business person might say, "The reason I called you is that I have a question about billing." English speakers often say, "The only reason," when there could be many possible explanations about why something is. Let's listen to Simon Sinek describe why people buy some kinds of technology.
The only reason these people buy touch-tone phones is because you can't buy rotary phones anymore.
Sinek's use of only reason adds a touch of humor to his talk. He could have also said, the reason these people buy touch-tone phones. But adding the word only gives the statement a bit more strength. In today's report, you learned about how to answer why questions. When you give a reason, you are explaining why something is or why something should be. The next time you listen to the news or watch television shows, pay careful attention to how speakers give reasons or explain why things are. Pay careful attention to how they use conjunctions, such as because, and how they use the noun reason. With time, you will learn how to give clearer explanations in English. Let's end this report with a few lines from the famous song Give Me One Reason, sung by Tracy Chapman.
Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around.
I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets, and they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.